Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Code Podcast.
Welcome back to the Short Code Podcast, your source for wit and wisdom from the students of the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Etler, and I'm so pleased to have with me today Eric Wilson and Rachel Goosen, M2s. Thanks, guys, for coming. And this week, the College of Medicine is holding its 8th annual conference on the intersections between writing and humanities. It's something we like to call the Examined Life, Writing, Humanities, and the Art of Medicine. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the show our featured presenter, writer, and lecturer on politics, culture, and psychology, Dr. Andrew Solomon. It's an honor to have you with us, Dr. Solomon.
It's an honor to be here.
Thank you so much. So your latest book is called Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. And it was chosen as one of the New York Times' 10 best books of 2012. It was on its bestseller list. It's won a raft of other awards. And it tells the story of parents who not only learn to deal with their exceptional children, but to appreciate them in a way that they might have thought was difficult prior to that. So, who are these people, and what kinds of things are they dealing with? What does that mean?
The central part of the book is divided into 10 chapters, which are deafness, dwarfism, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, multiple severe disabilities, prodigies, children conceived in rape, people who commit crimes, and people who are transgender. And it's framed with the discussion of my experience as a gay person, as the gay child of straight parents in the beginning, and as the father of children in the final chapter. Really trying to look at the ways in which families organize themselves when they have a child who has a condition that's foreign or alien to them, one that they don't know about, that they haven't heard about before, that they were unprepared for, and that wasn't what they had in mind when they set out to have children.
When I first started reading Far From the Tree, I was a little bit overwhelmed by just the scope of the subject matter and this idea of writing on something kind of as nebulous as identity. And I was really just amazed at how you were able to bring it all in. But I was wondering if you ever had any moments of doubt or worries about how you're going to tie everything together.
I had tremendous moments of doubt, and there were many days when I thought this book was really unwritable. It was so vast, it was so sprawling, those topics were so diffuse, the questions were so broad. But bit by bit, as I kept working away one chapter at a time, I began seeing that the connections which I had posited when I started really did exist. That while each of the subjects I was talking about can be written about unto itself, I could write a whole book about schizophrenia or a whole book about autism or a whole book about criminality, that actually the experiences of families who have children who are different in some way have a great deal in common. So if you think with a family that is for instance, dealing with a child with deafness, that you only have something in common with other families dealing with children with deafness, you're in a relatively small silo. But if you recognize these commonalities, you're in a large community, a community indeed of parents negotiating the difficulty of the ways their children differ from them, which constitutes much of humanity. So the connections were there, and I believed in the connections. But how to organize all of the material to make them manifest was very difficult, especially with this vast, vast amount of material. But that's it took me 11 years. There was a lot of working on it and revising it, and it's a fairly hefty book, but the first draft was more than twice as long.
Wow.
It's a lot of editing.
Yes.
You mentioned when you were at the deaf conference that it was hard to resist almost the desire to be deaf, to be part of that community, but that idea wasn't necessarily reflected in chapters about autism or schizophrenia. So what do you think made some of those identities attractive to you and some not so much, and how did you draw those lines?
That's a really interesting question. For autism, I was very convinced that the people who have a strong autistic identity find tremendous meaning in it. That there are people who really believe that their way of thinking is a different way of thinking, that it's every bit as valid as anyone else's way of thinking. It's the neurodiversity movement, and it really champions that idea. I wasn't drawn to that world so much, though I did get to be friends with some people who were members of it, because autism is, in many senses, a communication disorder, and communication is what I mostly do, and so the idea of having a communication disorder was troubling to me, but I accepted the validity of those people's claim that they were living a cultural identity. When it came to schizophrenia, I felt that it was a harder argument to make. And it's a harder argument in part, I think, because schizophrenia sets in so late. So if you imagine someone with autism without autism, you're really imagining another person, a person who's never existed. If you imagine someone with schizophrenia without schizophrenia, you're imagining who that person was until the age of 17 or 19 or 26 when the schizophrenia set in. I think that colors things very much. And I met people with autism who said, I'm so glad I have autism. I love having the mind that I have. The people I met with schizophrenia, on the other hand, some of them had remarkable lives and were doing amazing and interesting things. And some of them felt that their experience with schizophrenia had strengthened them. But I didn't meet anyone who said, I'm glad I have schizophrenia and I'd never want to imagine a life without it. They had found meaning in their difficult experience, but it was an unwelcome difficult experience.
When you mentioned just all the people that you've met, I was really just curious, how did you get in contact with most of the individuals that you interviewed and talked to for the book?
Finding the subjects for the book was an enormous enterprise. Some of them were easy. You say you're writing about autism, and everyone you meet says, oh, you must talk to my sister. Oh, you must talk to my friend. Oh, there's someone I know who just had a child who was diagnosed. So you had a great many people that way. For many of the topics, I went to national organizations. I went, for example, to the National Down Syndrome Society, who introduced me to some of the people in my Down Syndrome chapter. I went to the Little People of America conference, and that was where I met many of the dwarfs who featured in my dwarfism chapter. Some of them were more difficult. In order to find families bringing up children conceived in rape, I had to run ads on the internet that involved convincing the moderators of boards for survivors of rape that they should post an ad from a strange man seeking contact with the women in their purview. They were, of course, nervous about doing that, and it took some considerable convincing. For the chapter on people who commit crimes, I ended up taking a job in a juvenile prison in Minnesota and working there, working on a theater project, not as a prison guard, but still working there and getting to know a lot of the kids. And after I had got to know them, saying to them that I really would like to write about them and their families, and most of them were open to my doing it. So there were many different approaches. And some of the time, I just had my ear to the ground and I would meet someone who knew someone, or I would say what I was writing about in some public forum and someone would write to me, all kinds of ways. It's what I think gets called technically in the field a sample of convenience, meaning that there wasn't a specific methodology for finding them, but it was a sample of convenience that involved quite considerable inconvenience as I was locating all of the people.
When I look at this list of, you know, the sorts of people you're interested in speaking with, I think from some parents' points of view, probably a lot of parents' points of view, depending on the condition, it's like, you know, this is my worst nightmare as a parent.
The book is really about identity, yeah. And I was looking at two identity communities in each instance. I was looking at the people directly affected by a condition and at the way that their families were affected by their having that condition. I drew the distinction in the book between what I called horizontal and what I called vertical identities. Vertical identities are the ones that are passed down generationally from parent to child. So one's ethnicity, one's nationality, often one's religion, one's language. Those are things that parents are well set to understand because they have them in common with their children. And when we say that there are difficulties associated with some of those conditions, the response in general is not that we ought to change the conditions, but that we ought to change the society around them. So if it's harder still to be a person of color than to be a white person in America as currently constructed, we don't say that we want to do research into how to make sure the children next come out with blonde hair and blue eyes African-American parents. But there are then also these horizontal identities, which I call horizontal because the learning happens not from parent to child, but from a peer group. So all of the things that I've described are things that affect children and don't affect their parents. Well, for the parents, having children who are different in this way is a big shock. And the parents need to quickly become expert at how to find the correct treatment, the correct balance, the correct supports, whatever it is that their children are going to need. And in order to do that, they have to enter a community of other parents. And the advent of the internet has meant that there are now very tight communities, both of parents and of the people who are dealing with these conditions themselves. And there's a lot of dynamic interplay between those two communities, but they are two distinct communities. And I really think that the story of how families respond to these children is a sort of microcosm for how we as a society will respond respond to people who are different in any given way.
One of the themes that you really talk about is the challenges that parents face in recognizing that their child has this horizontal identity that is different from their own. But what are some of the advantages that you can see to the parent and child not sharing those same exceptional qualities?
I think that I go back to what an American sociologist said, which is that we not only take care of our children because we love them, but also love them because we take care of them. I think it's a very profound insight. And I think a lot of the time, this process in which families have to come to be expert in some complex way on the differences that they have with their own children, it's a very enriching and very vivid experience. It is not an easy experience, and I would never want to trivialize the difficulty these families face or the fact that some families really can't find a positive way through all of this. But for the families who do, the new understanding they have to arrive at, the leap they have to make as parents in order to understand their own children, can ultimately be very rewarding and very bonding. And I found that many of the people I was writing about were ultimately grateful for children who had conditions that they would, in effect, have done anything to avoid.
Just to follow up on that, I was reading through your interview with Peter Lanza, and I noticed that at the end, he actually acknowledged that he wished his son had never been born. And clearly, with his child, it's probably the most extreme example imaginable. But it really kind of made me tie all of your work together and wonder what variables you think make a parent draw that line where they can wish that their child had never been born versus recognizing those exceptional horizontal characteristics that make them unique.
Well, Peter Lanza, I think, both loved his son and wished that he had never been born. That shouldn't be taken to suggest that he only wished his son hadn't been born or that there wasn't a great deal of love there. And I think he wished that because of the injury that had been caused to other people. He said, if he was going to injure me, I could have accepted that. It's the destruction of all of these innocent children, he said, that becomes so horrific that there just is no way around it. But I found that people had very varied positions on these things. I mean, there was a family who I didn't deal with directly, but who had dealt with someone I was interviewing. The mother discovered that she was going to have a child who was a dwarf, and she decided to give the child up for adoption. She said, I was a cheerleader. My other daughter is going to be a cheerleader, and this child could never be a cheerleader. And she clearly just couldn't imagine life with this child, with these profound differences. So, you know, that certainly happens. I met one mother who had two children with autism, and she said, I love my children, I do everything for them, and if I had it to do over, I wouldn't have children, and I believe anyone who tells you otherwise is lying. So that point of view occurs in various places throughout the book and is a strong point of view. I think it's very highly personal, and I think it's a mistake to universalize. You know, I think it was a mistake to say in the 1960s and early 70s, if you have a child who has a difference, that child should be put away and sent away from the family and brought up by strangers in a care facility. That was not universally the right thing. But I think it can be oppressive to suppose that the universally right thing is to keep the child at home and to devote your life to the child. There are some people who are able to do that and some people who aren't. And some people who in doing that will give their children a wonderful life and some people won't give their children such a wonderful life. So I think there needs to be a society in which we recognize that different people have different capacities, that different people have different feelings about children who are different, and that we should support them. The only caution I would throw in is that I think a lot of the time the idea of a child with differences or disabilities or a stigmatized identity is different than the real experience of that child. And parents shouldn't rush to make a decision shortly after their child is born without having a full understanding of how the relationship might grow and develop.
We're just going to take a quick break. We'll be back in about 30 seconds.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
We're back, and we've been joined by Dviju Kumar.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for coming. She was off getting food for Dr. Solomon, who just was nice enough to hop off his flight and join us for this. So I appreciate your going a few minutes more without food. I don't know how you do it. Anyway, continue.
I wanted to come back to this. You mentioned about horizontal identities. And in Far From the Tree, you talk a lot about how the internet has been kind of a way for people to connect and find lots of other people who might share a similar identity. But you also mentioned that the book took 11 years or so to write. And even in the past few years, since the book was published, the internet has changed so much about how we interact with people. And I was kind of wondering if you ever had to rewrite chapters to take this into account, or if there's anything you would change now, seeing how this kind of online network has changed.
Not really. I think the internet has allowed people who have these conditions to find one another, and I think that's been possible for some considerable time. Of course, the ways that people congregate in social media are in flux and are changing, but essentially the issue isn't the nature of that internet interaction. It's the fact that people are no longer alone. You know, if it were sort of 1990 and your child was diagnosed with diastrophic dwarfism, you might have, as one of the parents in the book had, a short paragraph in a medical textbook describing this rare condition from which she said we were expected to live our whole lives. One paragraph in a medical textbook. We didn't know anyone who had the condition. We knew that it was rare. We had no idea how to find anyone who knew anything about it. Now, you type in diastrophic dwarfism and you're immediately connected to communities of people who are dealing with diastrophic dwarfism, and you can get an enormous amount of advice, and you can find out what life might look like for an adult with diastrophic dwarfism. There's, of course, a lot of misinformation on the internet, and that can be dangerous. And there's a lot of very partisan information on the internet in which strong political positions are taken in one direction or another that are not invariably relevant to what people need to discover. And so there's a lot of sorting that one has to do. But I don't think that the changes in the internet in recent years have really altered that fundamental reality. I think there have been advances, and I think probably things get steadily easier. And of course, a larger and larger proportion of the population is internet literate and is able to find things online. But I think that the basic structures have been there, you know, at least for some time, and that these communities grew up relatively early in the mass accessibility of the internet, because these were people who so much wanted to be able to find one another. It was not just that they thought it would be kind of fun. It was that they felt a desperate, urgent, and in some sense medical, in some sense social need to communicate with other people in like circumstances.
I was listening to your TED talk about depression, and I think you said something like how, you know, 50 years ago, if people had depression, they would have probably felt so lost because they wouldn't have had a lot of resources. And I was wondering if you thought that depression was becoming more prevalent nowadays because of the ubiquitous, like, social media and, you know, all these ads and media telling us how to be and portraying these kind of perfect identities that we strive towards. I didn't know what your thoughts were on that.
It would appear that depression is on the rise. It's very difficult to know, though, because it's also diagnosed much more frequently, and it's diagnosed much more frequently in part because we have more effective treatment for it. So in 1950, if you announced that you had depression, there wasn't anything much to do, and you didn't gain anything much by doing it. In 2014, if you say you have depression, there's a broad range of therapies that you might wish to pursue, both medicines and talk therapies, and in some cases, electroconvulsive therapy or deep brain stimulation and so on. That may have a transformative effect. So there's much more profit, not economic profit, but profit to people who describe the condition. Now, we therefore assume that the rate of diagnosis has gone up tremendously, and the question is whether the rate of depression itself has gone up tremendously as well. If the rate of depression has gone up tremendously, and I think it's certainly gone up at least a little bit, then we have to think about why that's happened. I'm not sure that it's because we're exposed to so many idealized versions of humanity, though I'm sure that that contributes in some instances. People have proposed such a range of possibilities as defies all description. You know, it may be because we sleep less than we did before the invention of first electric light and then television. It may be that it's because people spend a lot of time interacting with computers and not interacting with human beings, or interacting on the phone and not seeing faces, and that there are beneficial effects to direct interaction with other human beings that are not served by those functions. It may be because we live in a modern society in which people often live in crowded places, and it's overwhelming to deal with the crowded nature of things. It may be because of the overstimulus of all of the different media that we have coming toward us, and the way that people end up surfing among 200 television channels. I mean, they're just, I could go on for the next 45 minutes with a list of things that have been proposed. So I think it's hard to sort out. I think that those ideals of what one should be like have existed in some form or another for a long time. I think that those in some ways have more of an effect when they come into countries in which people had thought they were living well, and then see images of people living better in other countries and have a sense of despair about the place where they are, even if those portrayals of other countries are not strictly accurate. So I think that plays into it, but I think it's one of many, many factors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You know, you're here today at a medical school at a conference that's about medical education, and Eric and I are second year medical students. We're kind of just at the point in our education. We just had a unit on psychiatry, learning about how to diagnose depression, how to treat it, learning about a lot of the inadequacies of treatment today, which you've mentioned in your TED Talk. What do you think is the most important thing for kind of the doctors of tomorrow to know about depression?
Well, I would start by saying that the TED Talk is related to a book I wrote on depression called The Noonday Demon, which was a study in part of my own experience of depression and part of the science of depression, and really trying to break down the idea of depression as a modern Western middle-class illness by showing that it exists across societies, by showing that it's existed across time, and by looking at depression among the indigent. It's also a book in which I wanted to look at the mechanisms of resilience. And I think doctors would be well advised to consider the fact that depression does not come in a quantifiable form. So it is not the case that you can say to someone, you have bad depression, you have not so bad depression, you can therefore do this and you can therefore do that. There's an intersection between the condition and the person's underlying personality. And there are people who, despite what sounds, as they describe it, like very severe depression, manage to have worthwhile lives in between their depressive episodes, and there are people who, despite what sounds like milder depression, are completely undone by it. I think it's important for doctors to understand that the biological and the psychodynamic approaches to depression are really two different vocabularies for addressing the same set of problems, and that most people require an enormous amount of social support in therapy or in other ways as they reckon with the idea that they may permanently need to be in some kind of treatment for this condition, as they struggle with the sense of being betrayed by their own brains. So I would say that there has been the mistake in the sort of heyday of Freudianism of forgetting about the brain and our focus on the mind, which was dangerous. We've now moved to an era in which we're likely to forget about the mind and our focus on the brain, and we need to think about mind and brain in order to be able to help people and to identify the problems that people find themselves experiencing in both vocabularies at all times.
As medical students, we're confronted with a lot more death than your average Joe. And you had also mentioned that people with depression often struggle with the seeming futility of life and the inevitability of death. We're staring down the barrel of a lifetime of looking death straight in the eye on a pretty regular basis. How do you think those experiences might shape our identities, and what kind of mechanisms for resilience do you think might be extra important for medical students and physicians?
I think it's one of the real challenges of being a good doctor to be able to face down death on an ongoing basis. I remember when my mother was very ill toward the end of her life, saying to one of the oncologists who was treating her, "How can you bear to be in this work in which most of the people you treat die in so much pain?" And he said, "Because a few of them get saved." And I thought that was very moving. So I feel like medicine is something in which there is more exposure to death, but there is also more exposure to the sort of miraculous possibility of life under the most unlikely circumstances. There's no question that medicine is a stressful profession, and I'm grateful that you and others are willing to undertake it. We all rely so much on doctors and on medicine, and the people I've written about are always relying on doctors and on medicine to get through. In terms of mechanisms of resilience, you know, it's useful to be able to always hold on to the positive part in the face of the negative part. It's useful to know how much of the anguish you can actually bear to encounter or witness, and to determine what kind of practice you have on the basis of those abilities, and not to judge yourself if you have certain limitations on that front. I think most profoundly, it's important to think of the fact that even lives that end, and that end sadly, even lives as they wind down to death, have a great deal of value, and that the ability to give someone a little bit more of the valuable experience of life is, you know, the gift beyond all price. So it's to cling to that piece of it as you go through.
I know the last chapter of Far From the Tree, you talked about being a father and how your research into all these different families kind of led you towards that path. And I kind of felt the same way, that there's a lot of difficulties that you show in the book, and there's a lot of positives as well. But ultimately, I found the stories to be inspiring, just for the amount of love that could exist in even the most difficult of circumstances. But I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about that decision to become a father, especially given all this research.
I decided to have children while I was in the process of writing this book. And people said to me, how can you be deciding to have children in the middle of a book about everything that can go wrong? And I said over and over again, but it's not really a book about everything that can go wrong. It's a book about how much joy there can be in the experience of being a parent, even when everything seems to be going wrong. There are families in the book who have struggled mightily, and some of whom have really not made it. But I felt that what I wanted to look at in writing the book was the way in which people manage to build meaningful lives for themselves. And I think often of what one of the mothers I interviewed said, she has two children with, or had two children with, very severe multiple disabilities, neither of whom lived past the age of 12. And she said, people always give us these little sayings like, God doesn't give you any more than you can handle. But children like ours are not preordained as a gift. They're a gift because that's what we have chosen. And I felt strongly that while there are some people who are able to make that choice and some people who aren't, that there's nobody for whom these things are purely positive, meaningful experiences who hasn't made a distinct, conscious determination to work toward that ideal. And I wanted to capture as much as I could what that looks like and how people build meaning and forge identity. What is it like when someone actually achieves meaning and identity? So that was the driving force behind what I did.
Well, I hate to say it, but we're out of time. But I wanted to thank you so much, Dr. Solomon, for joining us today and be willing to sit down and talk with us at the Examine Life Conference and for the podcast today. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And I would be remiss if I didn't thank the UI Lecture Committee also for their help in bringing Dr. Solomon here. It's been great working with them, and nice to have some help of bringing the cool people to Iowa. So thanks for that. Dviju, Rachel, Eric, thank you also for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks to our listeners for putting in the time too. We know you have lots to do, and we're grateful for the time that you put in listening to us. So drink deep from that fire hose. See you soon.
Short Code is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter too. where we post not only our episodes, but news and info for medical students. We also take comments and story ideas from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com, or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. The producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by R.A.C. Thanks for listening.
What I see is a child.